Good morning.
Good morning.
I could say Happy Labor Day, and I guess we would all say yes and be joyful and cheerful. But today, I don't think we find labor and the labor movement in such a very good position. And if you want to know the story of labor in this country, I'm going to recommend a book. I don't think I've ever done that from the pulpit, but Labor's Untold Story. And I think you could get this book for $2.50, maybe $3, on a used book. And when you read it, have a box of Kleenex with you, because you might cry. I don't think many people know the first great labor movement and first great strike in the history, what we would say Western history. Don't fully understand it and don't really know how to put it together. But I think there's some similarities between that great labor movement and move toward liberation and equality of people of all classes and what's happened in this past century. And that labor movement and revolt happened in Egypt. It happened some 2,000 years ago or 2,600 years ago or so. And it is the story of Moses. And now, not many people put Moses together with labor, and some of you heard me say that, and you can, but it is. The Hebrew people lived in Egypt peacefully, especially after Joseph helped the Pharaoh get through some famines, and for several hundred years after the generations of Joseph lived there, they lived peacefully. And the Hebrews mainly did labor tasks. And they seemed to be comfortable and happy, and the people that were of the kingdom of Egypt and the Hebrew people, even though they were not the same and lived separate, they did not seem to have a lot of antagonism, and they did not war with one another. There was a coexistence. Then one day, the Pharaoh said, "My goodness, there are a lot of those folks out there, and if some of our enemies were to persuade them to join them, they could defeat our nation. So what we're going to do is we're going to make their laboring tasks extremely difficult so we can oppress them so that they would not be strong enough to fight against us." As best I can read, there was no indication that they wanted to fight against the people of Egypt. This was in the mind of the ruling class. This was in the mind of the Pharaoh. So he pulled the straw from the bricks and he made it hard. He made it more difficult to work. Terribly so. Maybe if we ever worked in a sweatshop or in a factory without safety conditions, we might get some understanding of what they were going through. In their cries of this oppressive labor, their God, Yahweh, said, "Enough. I will find you a deliverer to lead you out of Egypt." It wasn't about slavery per se. It was about the laboring conditions, because the laboring conditions is what changed to cause those people to cry for their God to hear them. Their God is a labor organizer. An organizer, community organizer, hasn't got a lot of positive press, because what community organizers do, they empower local people to stand up for themselves and give them a voice over against the powers that be. So here's Moses, and he leads his people out, and they go through terrible things. And you know, the first thing that Moses asked the Pharaoh for was not, "Let my people go so we can go forever and be gone." He said, "Let the people go on a 3-day religious holiday and give them a couple days off." He did not negotiate for complete total separation of the Hebrew people away from Egypt to go create their own nation. He said, "Can we get double time on Sunday, and can we get a religious holiday?" is essentially what he go read it. When I read that, I was going, what? This is about laboring conditions. That's when I really connected that you cannot really separate labor when laborers do not have a voice from slavery. They go together. You cannot separate it. During the slavery years, official slavery years in our nation, they were slave revolts. We could also call them strikes against poor living conditions. There were slave revolts in 1663, 1712, 1741, 1811. They were up to the Civil War. But this one particular one I want to call our attention to, it's called the Denmark Vassy's Uprising in 1822. A free black man living in South Carolina detested slavery and took great inspiration from the stories of Israelite freedom from bondage in the Bible. His outcome was not so good. He was killed. That also teaches us something. When we take great inspiration from stories from history to inspire us to go up against, to challenge the powers that be, often the outcome for the people who do that is not so good. Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Kennedy's. What happened during that time, pre-Civil War time? The southern plantation owners, wasn't just about slavery, it was about an economic way of life, and that they controlled the government of this country. So they could get whatever legislation they wanted. The Civil War was about which group of people was going to control this country, the northern industrialists or the southern plantation owners. That was a key dynamic. And the reason I say that it was about slavery, but we would like to say that slavery ended after the Civil War because the northern forces won. But when you look at the factory conditions in the North and from 1860 to the 1920s, it was another form of slavery. Slavery was replaced by slavery. The only thing that changed is who was in power and the words we used to describe it. So we had a labor movement. We did not have a slave revolt. I often wonder if we would have called the labor movement a movement of a slave revolt, would that change our attitudes? Would it change our attitudes to know that when we begin to remove regulation to protect workers, that's a movement back towards slavery? Would that change how we think if we use the term slavery? If we looked at not having a minimum wage, what people would pay, what they would do in their life, would we call that slavery? Would we call it slavery that a woman working with in the textile industry working with threads, and she has to change the threads from spool to spool, and if her fingers get cut off and she bleeds on the thread, she's got to pay for the thread that was bled upon. And she's working 12, 14 hours, 7 days a week. Would we call that slavery today? Well, that was the conditions during the labor movement. I thought I would read some thoughts about from articles pre-Civil War to get an understanding of the mentality of the people who controlled the economic system, to give us an understanding of that way of thinking. In case you thought, well, you make your own minds. Make your own minds up. This is the New Democratic Doctrine. Slavery will not be confined to the Negro race, but will be made universal condition of the laboring classes of society. So vote for Buchanan for president. Now, this was 1856. That's not present, Pat Buchanan. But I could see how you might get that mixed up if you just listen to him. Okay, so these are from the newspapers. The line of defense, however, is now changed. The South now maintains that slavery is right, natural, and necessary, and does not depend upon difference of complexion. The laws of the slave statutes justify the holding of white men in bondage. Slavery is the natural and normal condition of the laboring man, whether white or black. And I'm beginning to think, wait a minute, they're talking about me now. There was somebody running for president on this platform. And we'll get to a minute what they would do with people in poverty, as opposed to trying to educate, provide education, public education, as opposed to with welfare, moving people up so they can fulfill their dreams and opportunities. They had another plan for that. Repeatedly, we have asked the North, has not the experiment of universal liberty failed? Are not the evils of a free society insufferable? And do not most thinking men among this society think it's unnatural and unchristian to have this free society? It must fall and give way to a slave society, a social system, as the old, which is old as the world and universal as man. Now here comes a belief system that believes as long as humans existed, there were slaves, which is simply not so, simply not true. Furthermore, we have got to hating everything with the prefix free, from free Negroes down through the whole categories, free farms, free labor, free society, free will, free thinking, free children, and free schools belonging to that same brood of damnable isms. But worst of all of these abominations is the modern system of free school, which we know lifts people out of poverty, which we know provides people with a different worldview that they can see more opportunities in their life. Now here's where we Unitarians might feel a bit of a pinch. The New England system of the free school has been the course of a prolific source of infidelities and treasons that have turned the cities into Sodoms and Gomorrahs. Free public school, infidelities and treason. It is, and when we think of our first principle, the dignity of every human being, it is getting time that waiters at the North are convinced that they are not servants, that they are gentlemen in disguise. And one Irish waiter was shot by a Southern senator, and they said, rather than charge this man with murder, they said, well, I hope that will teach people not to think that they are gentlemen when they are really servants. And here is what we'll do with people in poverty. The New York Daybreak newspaper, one of the two newspapers in New York City that supported James Buchanan, proposes to enslave poor Americans, Germans and Irish, who may fall into poverty and unable to support their families. Here are the Daybreak's exact words in speaking of the poor white people. Sell the parents of these children into slavery. Let our legislature pass a law that whoever will take these parents also has to take the children and take care of them and clothe them, and they shall be servants as long as they shall live. So I guess that is one way to handle poverty. And it, since 1980, there are more people in poverty than in the 1970s, I guess you could structure society to move people into poverty, which would move people into slavery. Or have we done that? But we call it something else. Are people now living in homes that are on the edge of foreclosure and their homes are worth less than what they owe and they can't find good work, so they join up sometimes with other people and live in the same home and work in jobs that don't pay a living wage, and there's really nothing they can do about it? Who remembers the president when one woman said to him, "I've got to work three jobs in order to make a living," and the president's response was at that time, "Only in America. Only in America can this happen." So what is happening to the working class? And what can we glean from history if we don't like what's happening to the working class? We could do something different. What is happening? I'm saying today when we hear headlines that we have an economic recovery, but jobs aren't increasing, unemployment is increasing, but yet we're having an economic recovery, that the working class is once again becoming invisible and of no merit. And if you can funnel more people into the working class and overcrowd the working class, then there are 1,000 people applying for one job, you can pretty much do what you want to do. So the working class is becoming invisible. I am suggesting that today, and I thought I would give two examples from recent history, from the 50s to now, and where this is one way of how the working class stays invisible, and another example is one way how the working class does not stay invisible. In 1935, England made the discovery that asbestos caused cancer. 1935. Well, they must have kept that secret, because the United States didn't discover that until 1959. And what happened in 1959 when they discovered that, especially in the steel mills and in the blast furnaces, every 10th row of brick was asbestos, dealing with the intense heat. So they took them to court, and they said, the bricklayers are getting more cancer and dying in their mid-50s than anybody else, you know, and what's going on, and they think it's because of this. And so the decision was that every year the bricklayers would have a physical examination. Every year they would go to the doctors and have a physical examination. So jump forward almost 20 years, and in 1975, a union president took note that the bricklayers were still dying. He said, well, what's going on? So he would go to the widows, and he asked. He says, well, they had to go to the doctors once a year. What's with that? And they said, well, they did. They went to the doctors once a year. He said, well, why would you go to the doctors once a year and get diagnosed with cancer and then continue in the same job? Well, you know, what's going on with that? So it got all the way to a congressional subcommittee meeting, and they got Dr. Franz on the stand, and he had the records, and he was interpreting the records from 1959 to 1975. And so the prosecutor, because now this was a crime, if they could convince it, in which possible management would go to jail. So this was a big deal. So they asked the doctor. They said, "Well, doctor, did you administer these exams, and you got these records, and did these men indeed have cancer?" And he said, well, yes. And then he asked, well, didn't you tell the patient? And the doctor said, well, yes. And then the prosecutor got confused, because he knows he wasn't telling the people that got the exams. And he said, well, who's the patient? Well, the patient's Bethlehem Steel, because they hired me. And I gave them all the records. They know what's going on. The workers are invisible. Now, recently, in the previous presidential administration, when they put people in the Department of Labor that favored business, they began to introduce language, and I thought it was introduced for the first time until I got this story, and the language was that business is our client. businesses are consumer. This is the Labor Department created to guard labor, and now the Labor Department's going through a transition where... So that's how we remain invisible. That's how workers remain invisible in this world. They're not even the patient. The company is the patient and holds that information. That died and nobody went to jail. Another story, and this is how to be not invisible. Another story, the coal miners. It became evident after they'd done some autopsies that there was such a thing called black lung disease, because people's lungs would be black. They went to court and they said, no. They had doctors, a panel of doctors said, no, there's no such thing as black lung disease. The other people are looking at black lung. And these doctors are going, no, that's not true. As a matter of fact, the coal dust is good for people. Now, I'm not making it up. This is congressional records. Okay? And we wonder where Yahweh is leading these people out. Where is the ultimate good of a culture? Where is the ultimate value of a culture when we have the leaders of our culture doing this to the working class? Where is the ultimate good or values? So they got the black lung legislation into Congress. And as we are watching Congress work for however old we are, that's how long we've been watching or ignored because we might feel helpless, it was going nowhere and it was stalling. The entire coal industry, all the workers in the coal industry, I don't say all, but most, went on strike. And you know what they went on strike for? They said, we are not going back to work until Congress passes the legislation honoring black lung disease and treating people that have black lung disease and begins to move in the mines to prevent black lung from happening. How you remain not invisible was to speak up and to organize and withhold labor, because that's the only power labor has, is to withhold labor. And Congress passed it. And we began getting coal throughout society again. Two examples. Now, I want to talk just briefly what I think the most egregious or the most difficult to deal with, but the most harmful about making the working class invisible, having an economic recovery when people are still suffering, jobless, losing their homes, where companies are making profit. Those are the articles that are in the paper today. Genocide. When we think of genocide, we think of the physical and the brutal wiping out of a people. That's what we think when we think of genocide. Christopher Bolas, who's a psychoanalyst, who's a theorist, he said there's another form of genocide. There's an intellectual genocide. There's an intellectual genocide where you can take the way of a people, how they think, how they exist, how they relate to one another, the worldview that they have. And if you can take that group of people, and if you can eliminate their worldview, if you can eliminate how they think, if you can eliminate that culture, that is an act of intellectual genocide. If the working class, which I consider, I mean, if we step out and look at history, we've experienced one of the greatest slave revolts in human history in this country from the 1890s to the 1930s. How many of us have benefited from the labor movement? How many of us have Social Security, pensions, living wage jobs? How many of our parents were able to send us to school when they wouldn't have been able to send us to school? I mean, we have been a part of a revolution and a revolt that has been absolutely staggering and amazing. But is it dying now? Is that the state of labor? Here's an example of how intellectual genocide occurs in this country. In the 1930, the International Workers' Order got together and they incorporated under insurance, the insurance company in New York State. And what they did in this insurance company in New York State, their purpose and statement was to provide insurance benefits, advancing the mutual protection of health, cultural, educational, and recreational interests of the well-being of its members, working men, and their families. Can you imagine an insurance company having that agenda? I think I like that. The national societies that were involved with this particular International Workers' Order insurance company, they provided concerts, folk festivals, dramatic performances, pageants, dances, lectures, sports tournaments, and so on. It was a way of life. They provided insurance for people far below the privatized insurance companies because their mission statement was to serve the working people. In the 1950s, they got put on the list, a blacklist of people who were friends of communists. They tried to close them down, and they sent inspectors in, and they could not find anything wrong with the financial process and what this particular company was doing. And as a matter of fact, the first time they went to court, the judge said, "Hey, no, these people are fine." But then after the Red Scare intensified, another judge withdrew and gave New York State permission to withdraw their licensure as an insurance company, and they dissolved, and that organization dissolved, and that organization went away. And the reason why I say that's intellectual genocide, I have not heard of an insurance company today that has the well-being of the people they serve in mind. And if it's a working class people, they are not gearing their insurance prices and giving up some of their profit to take care of that group of people. I've not heard of it. It doesn't exist. But it did exist. It did exist. And it was so strong and so powerful, it got eliminated. And then I think of who we are as Unitarian Universalists, 159,000 people on Sunday meeting. Are we in jeopardy of intellectual genocide? How many of us can go into a crowd and speak freely, we are liberal thinking people, and feel safe? The only thing we can do is model ourselves after the coal miners and organize with like-minded people and like-minded groups and take a stand. Otherwise, are we in danger? Our way of thinking, the Northerners, are we in danger? I'm saying, yes, we are. How do we get enough courage to stand up against the powers that be? To walk the bridges when we're asked to walk the bridges and protest, to go to the healthcare meetings when they have the healthcare meetings, and stand and talk when it's very intimidating to find yourself in a crowd that doesn't think like you. My words for us today are that we have that inner courage to do just that.